Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about shells generally and some things that are coming up in our shell assignment. So you mentioned redirection. So redirection is where we could specify, oh, I want to run this command, but I want its output to go somewhere when it usually go, or its input to come from somewhere when it usually go. So that's just sort of specify, you know, specify different, you know, input or output. I guess a point of confusion I've seen a couple times about this is that this is input, like, you know, where you, like, you know, read from, you know, the keyboard versus a file, etc. This is not arguments. Arguments on a command line are independent of this. We mentioned that that's passed through exempt V as just a list. And we also have pipelines, which are, we can send output from one command to another. And in order to deal with, well, how do we specify different input or output, including input or output that might come from or go to another program, we need to understand how our file descriptors work. This is how in Unix-like systems we're going to specify, you know, what files we can access and how we access files. And we sort of know about, like, opening a file and getting access to it. But in POSIX, the way we access files is with these NUT indexes, these file descriptors that point to the open file information. And when we do something like fork, we copy the pointer. So we actually end up with multiple pointers to the same open file. And we can assign a pointer with one index to another with this dupe to operation. And that's how we change what the input or output is. The convention on Unix systems is that we say, oh, we're always going to use number one for output or number zero for input. And we can run a program changing what is one or zero. So when the program follows that convention to say, oh, I'm going to look for my input at zero, it will find the input we choose rather than what was set up by default, which typically we'd imagine would be like the terminal. We also mentioned, well, closing sets a pointer to null. So it was confused as people because, oh, well, wait a moment, I closed a file and therefore no one else can access it. That's not how it works. So closing is a file descriptor operation. So it means that you can no longer use index zero if you call close with zero to access that thing, but there might be other pointers to it. Those are still going to be valid. The operating system is going to be responsible for figuring out when there's no more references to some open file, and then actually releasing the resources associated with accessing it. So, and last time we started by talking about pipe. So we have a mentioned that we had a way of getting a pair of connected file descriptors, which we'll finish up looking at a few examples of today. So before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
Can we go over the last question on the quiz?
Can I go over the last question on the quiz? This. Where did I put my browser window? Did I close my browser window? Probably close my browser window. Okay, sure. So, so on the quiz, our final question was here and asks some things about how the file descriptor is set up. So we're told initially we have this output of 4, 5, 6, 7. Which means that A points to 4. Oh, sorry, that file descriptor 4 points to an open file, which is A.txt for reading and writing. File descriptor 5 to B.txt for reading and writing, and so on. And let's start with, start with what happens to a.text. So a.text, initially, file descriptor 4 is open to it. Then we do dupe 2, 4, 6. And that's going to mean that now file descriptor 4 and file descriptor 6 point to a.text. That's what that operation does. And later on, we do dupe 2, 6, 5. So that now means that after that operation, file descriptor 5 will also point to a.text. So it looks like we have this case where after that third dupe 2 call, we have file descriptors 4, 5, and 6 all pointing to a.text. Then we have this dupe 2 7, 4, and that's going to overwrite what 4 points to. So 4 is no longer going to point to a.text. And then we have a close of 6, so 6 is no longer going to point to a.text, but we still have 5 left over. And as far as sort of the general approach for reasoning about this, I would just say, okay, I have 4, 5, 6, 7. I say, what do they point to? And go through the code, go through line by line what happens. So 4, 6 means we take get rid of what 6 was pointing to and make a point of what 4 points to. The close means we get rid of what 6 is pointing to and now it points to nothing. And that's how we see what files are accessible. What open file descriptions those file descriptors point to. So questions on that sort of approach or other more specific things about? Yes?
When I was looking in the notes, it talks about dupe 2. Does it close what it's pointing to?
So question, dupe 2, does it close what it's pointing to? So when dupe 2 overwrites a pointer, we have to keep track of whether there's any references to that, what that thing was pointing to, still. And that should be taken care of properly. And remember, our close operation was just unsetting a pointer. So dupe 2 effectively unsets a pointer to set it again. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Can we go over number 1 on the quiz?
Go over number 1 on the quiz. Okay, so number 1 on the quiz, we have this code here where we have some variables that are global, some variables that are local, and for the most part, this is a red herring. So fork copies the whole process. That means all the variables, doesn't matter if they're global or local, we copy all of those, and the child and parent have an independent version of all of those. So we can reason about this by looking at what happens in the parent and the child after this fork operation, because we know before this fork operation, there's nothing output. So let's think about the parent. In the parent, PID is going to be a positive number. That means we're not going to go into this abort. We're not going to go into this if statement here. We're just going to write out one byte from global pointer, which points to A, lowercase, and one byte from X, which points to A, lowercase. So the parent's going to write out AA. The child, well, it's going to call anchor global of 1. Global pointer points to this X here, so that's going to be incremented by 1 to B. If we look at an ASCII table, A and B are right next to each other for both uppercase and lowercase. Then we make the pointer point to our capital A. We increment that by 1. And so that's going to be capital B. And then we output the capital B and the lowercase b. So we have uppercase B, lowercase B, and two lowercase a's being output simultaneously, and they just can be interleaved in any way because we don't know whether the parent or child execute first or interleaved in any way. So our two answers are just any interleavings of AA and capital B, lowercase b. And that's A and B are the options which do that. The other options are having us output too much of something, or not output two A's is the easiest way to see. We know there's two A's output from the parent, they aren't there, so there's something wrong with those. Questions? Yes, back there?
Can you clarify the wait PID when it has the negative one argument for the PID? Can it wait for grandchildren, or is it only your children?
Okay, so for wait PID, so this is probably you're talking about this question.
Yeah.
So wait PID can only wait for children. So with negative one, it will wait for one of the children. We do happen to know that because fork definitely last returned a positive number, that there is a direct child when we call wait PID here, though. Yes. So when we call wait PID with PID of minus one, what are we waiting for? We're waiting for the first child to finish, whichever one is available first. Yes?
So the first child will always have PID minus one?
No. So the question is, the first child will always have PID minus one. Minus one is a special value you can pass to wait PID to indicate, I don't care what process I wait for, just I want to wait for any of my child processes to finish. And it will give you whatever one has its exit or has its finishing status available first. Okay. Question over there.
So in this case, we can just replace negative one with the actual PID of the child, right?
So in this case, because there's exactly one child for each parent process, and that child's PID is P, we could replace negative one with P, and the effects would be exactly the same. Yes. Will the wait PID still return the child's PID if the child exits with an error? Yes. Wait PID always returns the PID that was waited for, if there is any. Or if wait PID fails, so for example, if you call wait PID when there's no child processes, it will return negative one. Yes?
Why can't an X be output before a Z?
Because this wait PID here waits for the child process, the grandchild process, to finish in our child before we output the X. And in the parent, it waits for the child to finish outputting its X before it outputs the parent's X. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Question, couldn't the OS switch back to the parent process before switching to the child? So before switching to the grandchild, the parent process will be waiting for the child to finish, to call exit.
Does that include the grandchild? Like,
so the parent process is here, waiting for the child, and the child process is also there, waiting for the grandchild. So there's this dependency chain, so that parent, neither the parent nor the child can do their write until the grandchild does. Yes? If the highest level parent forked into three different children, what do you mean? In what way? There's multiple ways we could do it.
So if there were three children instead of one child, they're the first parent.
So if there were three children instead of one child, and they were all doing the same thing, well, yes. Then in that case, the wait PID would only wait for one of them, one of the children.
So what if all the people were here?
So if we were three children, we presumably have calls to fork whose values we could have put somewhere or not, and we would need to know how they were stored. Okay, other questions? Okay. Yes?
This isn't about the quiz anymore, but if you close the last reference to a file, is that akin to like deleting it, or does it?
If you close the last reference to a file, is that akin to deleting it? So for files that like are on disk, well, we have another way of accessing them by their name. And as long as you have you can have a name that references it, you're still fine. For files of other types, like pipes, yes. So pipes don't have a name. Like, we just use this pipe call, we get file descriptors to it, but there's no actual like name we can use to like open it normally. In that case, yes, the last reference goes away, the pipe is going to be freed. Yes? Can I explain what we mean automatically on ORS? So we saw that in the XV6's implementation, we had this data structure that like tracked information about an open file, which had things like whether it was readable or writable, where we were in the file. That data structure is going to be freed when there's no more references to it. Okay. Other questions? So one brief note. So there's some anonymous feedback pointing out correctly that I made the schedule have readings that didn't make sense. What happened is I moved the lecture topics and didn't adjust the readings accordingly. So there were readings for what we're covering today on last week, which I'm sorry I confused people. Okay, so last time we were talking about pipe. So here's some code which is a bit buggy. And the bug is that, you know, this reads 0 bytes instead of 1. And what we're expecting is that, you know, I call pipe in the child, I create I close the read end of the pipe because we don't need it, and write the character A. In the parent, I close the right end of the pipe because we don't need it, and I read the character A. That's the intention, but that doesn't happen. There's some bug here. So anyone can tell me what the bug is? Yeah? Do I have to wait for the child process? So it would probably be a good idea to wait for the child process, but we probably don't want to do that until after the child process actually writes something to us and we read it. As we'll talk about in a bit, I think I have. Maybe I don't have that. So I guess I'm going to need to mention it. So the pipe has a limited amount of storage, so we want to be able to read it as it's writing. Yeah. Question, I'm writing in the child, so I'm reading the parent. Will there be two completely separate pipes because I forked at the beginning? Yes, so the writing in the child, reading the parent, that's not the problem. The problem is that we have, that this is called after forking. So what we end up with is we have our parent process, we split off into two processes, our parent and our child, and we have one pipe number one here, and pipe number two here. And they're two different pipes because we called pipe twice. So they're not connected to each other. So what's our fix here? Here, so the easy change is that if we move this up here, you'll get the intended result. Yes? What? Why would the pipe put before the fork? Because each call to pipe makes a new pipe. We want one pipe that's shared between these two processes. If we call it after fork, we have two separate calls to pipe, and they aren't shared. And I'm mentioning this as an example because this is a really common problem that people have on the shell assignment. So other questions about this? Yeah?
Can you repeat why calling the pipe, like after the pipe FES2 was like incorrect?
So the reason calling the pipe here was incorrect is because we called it, if we think about our process, we call it once in the parent and once in the child. So that's two different pipes. We wanted just one. So what was happening is we were writing to a pipe that no one was reading from, and reading from a pipe that no one was writing to. And the reason we got a zero is because, well, not only was no one writing to the pipe, but no one could write to the pipe. There was no open file descriptor for the right end of the pipe. So no file descriptor pointing to the right end of this pipe. So without the fix, that's why we got a zero, meaning end of file. So, yes.
Is the reason why it can't read is because like the other process put data into the wrong pipe, so there's nothing there for the other process?
Okay, the reason why it can't read, the other process put data into the wrong pipe, so there's nothing there? Yes. So if someone had access to the other end of that pipe, maybe we get something. Yeah.
What if you don't close the pipes?
What if I don't close the pipes? That's a great question. So if I don't close this pipe, so let's say I get rid of this. So in that case, without moving our pipe call. So I'm assuming we're talking about not closing the pipes, but we still have this pipe call in the wrong place.
So,
if we have it in the right place, then in this case, you're going to get lucky, and it will appear to behave correctly. But this would not be something you'd want to do on the assignment, because I read one byte. What typically we think of programs, if you're going to like read from your input, you'll read until like you get end of file. So if it's not closed, we will never get end of file. In particular, if this right end here is not closed, we will never get end of file, because what's going to happen for pipes is that if the OS thinks someone could write to it, including you, your process could write to it, you're never going to read end of file, because they don't know that something won't be written to it later. Now, if we had not moved the pipe call, so we had the incorrect pipe call, and we didn't close, in that case, our read would hang forever. So the read only returns zero in this case, in the original example, because there was no one who could write to the pipe. If we had the write file descriptor still open, then it would just hang, because hypothetically, there's some way we could write to it, even though we know with this code that's not really possible. But the rule is in POSIX is just that if someone can write to it, reads don't return, and a file, they just hang. Other questions? Yeah. Can I explain why I have to close the other end before writing or reading? Closing it before reading, we want to do, because otherwise we'll never get end of file. Closing it before writing, not strictly necessary, but it's good not to waste file descriptors, because that table is in finite size. And you'll run out eventually if you don't make a habit of closing things you aren't using. So it's just good habit to do that, which is why I do it in my example. Yes? What does the pipe function do? It creates a pipe, which is something, a sort of pseudo file that we can read and write from, and gives us a write file descriptor to it and a read file descriptor to it. Yes?
So the pipe is basically generating some temporary file that's just the input and output read, right?
It's a question, the pipe generating a temporary file that's just an input and output redirect between two things? That's kind of what it does. So it doesn't generally have a file on disk. And I guess I should do. And it has some storage for some data that's being passed between. And you can only read it once. It's not like a normal file where you can go back to the beginning. It's not how pipes work. You can write something and read it back. You can't like go back and read it again. Okay, so let's do another. Size with pipes. Okay, so who would like some more? So I'm asking here, so I have a child process that's writing 0 through 9 through pipe, and a parent process that's trying to read 10 bytes from the pipe. So my question is, what are possible outputs here? So who would like some more time? Okay, a couple of people, you can check with your neighbors. Oh, oops. Oh, wow. That is not good. Sorry about that. Not sure how that happened. Okay, so who thinks A? Okay, phew. B? C? Okay, D? So, E? Go for that. F? Okay, so so the correct answer turns out to be A and B. So most of you figured out, I think, that, oh, depending on when exactly we call read, we could have varying amounts of things available. And this tells us a few things actually are going on. So one thing that's going on is that the OS is buffering the written data before you read it in some way, like that we can have more than one thing available to read. So the pipe actually has some storage. It's a limited amount of storage. So if we kept writing indefinitely, yes, you'd eventually run out, in which case the write would pause. It would hang. But you can't get zero because there's a special rule with read, is that read, unless you do something special, is going to wait for some input to be available or to know that there's no more input. So read won't return zero unless you're actually at the end of a file. Nothing else can be written. Otherwise, it will just wait for that first write to happen. And for example, when I actually run this, I get something like this. This is the distribution I get of output. So I have 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 2, with some frequency, depending on just on how the timing works out for when that read happens versus the write. Yes? This is the number of times in my experiment I saw, and this is the output in the other column. Does that answer your question? So just on my system, depending on how fast things ran, I got a whole bunch of different possibilities. Yeah.
Can you go back to group?
Sure.
So at the end of this it only closes, each process only closes one of the pipes.
So question is, do we have some open file descriptors at the end? Absolutely. Well, we have, so we don't have any in the child because it exited, but we do have one in the parent. The read-in is still open. Does that answer your question?
Exit will close any open file descriptors.
What?
Will exit close any open file descriptors?
Question, will exit close any open file descriptors? Yes, because the process goes away, so there's no more references to those open files. Yes?
So is pipefd0 the input file?
So is pipefd0 the input? Yes. It's the read end of the pipe. Your question? What's the point of this first close here? So this close is just because we don't need to write to the pipe from the parent, so we're going to get rid of the file descriptor that would let us do that.
How about the one up off?
And for the child, we have this close here, which is we don't need to read from the pipe, so we're going to close the file descriptor to do that. So what if we don't do that? So in this example, not doing this would just mean that we're wasting space. If we cared about getting end of file from read, then not closing the write end would be a problem, because the read would hang if we had a write end open. Whereas otherwise, we could keep reading until we got end of file, and which would happen after the child exited, and therefore no one could write to the pipe anymore. Yes? So the question is, the most likely case for B is that the parent calls read, there's nothing in the pipe, and so it waits for the child to write, yes. Another possibility is that the child just wrote 0, and read's going to give you that. Okay. So this is some rules for read and write. So read, returning 0, always means end of file. Read does something different on there's no data available, but the file could have some more data later. If you want read not to wait when there's no data available yet, you have to do something special for that. So by default, if there's no data available, read's going to wait. So if you read from the keyboard terminal, you know, and then no key presses, it's not going to return 0. Generally, it's going to say it's going to wait for something to come in. And the same thing is true for pipes. And read can return less than requested if something's not available. So if something is available, read's not going to wait for your full amount to be available. It's going to give you something. You mentioned that sort of read and write return up to a certain number of bytes. And this means that if you're using read, you know, for example, to read from a pipe or the network, you often will have some sort of loop where you like call read multiple times to handle this, oh, I got part of my output, but not all of it. Because otherwise you're gonna get little chunks at a time, rather than like if you want to read like a kilobyte, as in this example, you have to try multiple times. Okay. Questions about partial reads? Yes? Question, how does read? Read is the way we read from any file descriptor. But when read is reading from something like a network or a keyboard or a pipe, you know, there's often going to be cases where not all the data you ask for is available. Read's going to return what is, except if nothing's available, in which case it will wait for something to be available. Yes? Where is read called in this exercise? It is called down here. Yes.
So in this example, when the input is less than 10 characters long, won't read just return 0 because you reached the end of the file?
Question, when the input is less than 10 characters long, won't read just return 0? So end of file for a pipe or a keyboard means there's no more possible input. It doesn't mean there's no input right now. It's a good question. Yeah, so that's the distinction. So for a pipe, end of file means that no one can write to this pipe anymore. Everyone's closed their ability to write to the pipe. For keyboard, it means that you aren't going to get any more keyboard input for some reason. Typically on Unix, you type Control D to indicate this. But it's not the same as there's no input right now. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's... Let me... Okay, so let's do that again. And I wanted to pull up... Something I pointed out about pipe. So I mentioned that, you know, pipe stores some data that's waiting to be read, right? We saw that in that example earlier, that we could have a bunch of things that were written in separate little calls and have it. That storage is not of infinite size. So in this example here, I'm using a pipe from one process, which is allowed, but if I'm writing a huge amount of data to the pipe, we're going to run out of space. And the behavior of pipes is that when we run out of space to store things that are waiting to be read, the write's going to wait for that space to be freed up. And in this example, that will never happen because the read won't be able to be reached until the write finishes. And I mention this because this is sort of a reason why, you know, pipes work the way they are, used the way they are. So in a shell, like when we run things in a pipeline, we run the two commands at the same time. So while one's writing, it will stop waiting for the other to read, which is usually what we want. But if you try to use pipes in sort of a naive way like this, you'll end up with things hanging. And confusingly, you'll end up with them hanging depending on exactly what size you use, which is where people get confused. So questions on this hanging behavior? Yes?
Do you need to guarantee in some way that if you have a parent and a child running and one is writing and the other is reading, that just by happenstance in the OS, the one of them won't write more than the other?
So the question is, if we know the parent and child are writing together, do we have some guarantee that one won't write more than the buffer can hold? No, but that's fine, because if one writes more than the buffer hold, it will just be paused until the other gets to read. So as long as they're actually running at the same time, this isn't a problem. But if you like try to run them one after the other, no, the pipe's not going to hold all the data in general. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that's on pipes and such, which took way more time than I thought it would, but that's fine. So questions on our Unix file API and pipelines and pipe? Okay. So our next topic is going to be about running processes. And I'm going to finish up one little thing, which is we're going to talk about how XV6 manages processes. And there's in XV6 this array of processes. So you might say, this seems like a bad idea. What if I want to run more than whatever nproc is processes? Yeah, so other OSs don't have an array like this. They use some more dynamic data structure, but XV6 is keeping it simple, right? If we have a fixed-sized array, we don't have to like deal with malloc. Saves us a lot of time. And there's also this lock to keep more than one thing from accessing the list of processes once. This is especially important since XV6 supports multiple cores. So we'll learn more about locks later. The sort of summary is that a lock is a way of making sure only one core or program uses this data structure at a time. And we can acquire the lock to say, only I'm using it right now, and release it to say, other people can use it now. And acquire will wait for us, anyone else, to be done. And we haven't talked about how XV6 sort of starts up processes much. We say, so how do we allocate something in the struct? And They just scan for something that's marked as unused. So there's the state value. If it's unused, they can use it. They just find the first one. If I say, this seems inefficient, sure it is. But it's simple. And one thing we haven't talked about is, how do we boot? So when we boot, there's a process running. And all the ways we know to start processes kind of require us to already have a process running. So XV6 has some code for this in user init. So it allocates one of those struct procs. And it fills it in with a hard-coded program. So in the XV6 kernel, there's this hard-coded program which calls execv on slash init. And it just sets things up to jump to the beginning of that program after it returns. So that's how we start the first process. So we just hard code that we execv slash init on boot. That's what the first program that runs is. And on XV6, that program that's supplied runs the shell. Questions on our initial program? Yes? What is init UVM? So the init UVM is a function that just loads that hard-coded program into memory, into user memory, which is where the name comes from. User virtual memory, probably, is what they're thinking of from the name. Other questions? Okay. So that's rooting. And we see here that one of the other things we do is we mark the process as runnable. So once we do that, something's going to take care of actually running it. So what is that? Well, we're going to talk about that as our next topic, which is scheduling. So how do we run things that are runnable? How do we choose what to run? We're going to look at that. And we're going to talk about running threads, because that's what modern OSs do. And I mentioned that in XV6, each process has exactly one thread. So I want to remind you that, well, we have our process control block, but some things in here are really thread control block things. And this is what we're going to be concerned about scheduling. We're going to be concerned about scheduling these threads. And XV6 is the same as scheduling processes, because every process has exactly one thread. And there's no threads that aren't part of processes. But on a more modern system, we'd have a process with multiple threads. And we're going to talk about scheduling. We're talking about scheduling these threads. And typically, the way we do that is we just have a list of the threads, regardless of what process they're actually attached to. You know, even though these threads might share the same code as others, from the perspective of the things we're going to look at soon, we're going to say, OK, we just have a list of these threads. And when I start running it, I'll need to know where the code is. And that's the same as something else. But that's generally not what we're going to talk about for scheduling decisions. We're just going to look at, you know, is it this thread or this thread or this thread? And for thinking about threads, we're going to track them as sort of going through certain states. And in XV6, we have this state variable here, process state, which is a thread state. And we have this sort of flow chart, or, you know, or finite automaton, if you remember theory, of the states. So we start off in this being created state, which XV6 calls embryo, which is something that's not ready to run yet, but is allocated. And then it becomes what we'll call ready, or what XV6 calls runnable. This is something we could put on the CPU, but we don't have on this running on the processor right now. Then we have a state called running when it's actually on the CPU. And sometimes we'll do something like ask to read from the keyboard, or you'll wait for something to happen. We'll call this state waiting, or XV6 calls it sleeping. I'm going to use the term waiting most of the time, because I think most of you don't think of waiting for a key on the keyboard as sleeping. That's what XV6 calls it. And we also have this finish state, which XV6 calls zombie, which is that it's terminated, but maybe not waited for. So remember, wait PID like needs to return statuses of things that have already finished. The way XV6 handles that is it sets it to the zombie state, but keeps it around until that status is retrieved. Yes? So question, can I explain the difference between ready and running? So question, is when something is running, is it always going to wait? No. So this is why we have an error from ready to running, from running to ready, or running to waiting. So sometimes it will do something that will need to wait, and sometimes we'll just decide, oh, you could keep using the CPU, but I have something else to do, and we'll just move it to this ready state. So even though we could keep running it, we won't until later. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So what's the difference between going through running to waiting versus going directly from running to ready? Going from running to waiting, when we're in the waiting state, even if the OS wanted to, it can't put us on the CPU. An example is if we're waiting for keyboard input, we can't go on the CPU while that's happening. Going to the ready state means that we could still run. So like we're running a big loop, that's doing lots of computation. Yes, we could go on the CPU right now. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. So question is, what updates these states? So these are things that are going to be maintained by our exception handlers and our system calls. So like going into this waiting / sleeping state is going to be one of the things that doing a read call might do if you need to wait. Going to this finish state is what the exit call will do. Having a timer interrupt go off will probably move you from running to ready. Does that answer your question? Yes? Question, what converts from embryo to runnable? This is something that's done as part of fork. So fork is going to need to set up the new struct proc. As it's doing that, it's going to be marked as an embryo until it's ready to run it, in which case it will mark it as runnable. Does that answer your question? Over there? What happens after the zombie state? Then it becomes. Then we free up the process control block for reuse.
So basically, it's gone.
So it's gone. Yes, in XV6, it's just marked as unused, so we can allocate it later. Other questions? Yeah.
So XV6 has one thread per process, but actual machines, like commercial ones, have multiple threads?
So question, XV6 is one thread per process, but actual machines have more than one? So XV6 is one thread per process, but every sort of commercial OS of use probably supports more than one thread per process. So this is sort of one view of what happens with processes. Another sort of way of looking at things is rather than looking at what does each individual thread do, we can sort of think of threads as moving through a set of queues, of lists. And we have a ready queue of the things that are waiting to be on the CPU but aren't. Those are the threads in the ready state. We have a runnable thread that's on the CPU, or if we have multiple cores, maybe more than one. And we have a bunch of queues for threads that are in the sleeping or waiting state that are waiting to be moved away. And I talk about this as a queue, but you know, if we think of, well, when we look at how we actually choose what to put on the CPU, we'll learn that this is not like a normal queue. This is some sort of weird priority queue. So this is another view of things. And we're going to talk a bunch about a big question, which is, if I have this ready queue here, what do I take off the list first? Now, in XV6, we don't actually have a queue for this. We don't even have anything that resembles a list. The way XV6 figures out what things are in this conceptual ready queue is by scanning the entire process table and checking if state equals runnable. On many OSs, they don't do this, and they have their own list because that's faster, but XV6 is just keeping things simpler at the cost of, you know, more time in execution. Yes?
Is the queue for one process or for everything?
Question, what is this queue? Is this queue for one process for everything? This queue is for the whole system.
Okay.
So here we were looking, so previously we were looking at each thread, here we're looking at all the threads together. That answer your question?
This queue is for threads, but also queues for processes.
Question is this queue for threads and all three processes? So we're going to think about threads always as the unit that's in these queues. Because we put a thread on the CPU, we don't put a process on the CPU. When we have multiple processes with multiple threads, you have to choose one of those threads to run at a time. Yes?
So in XV6, there's like the ready queue is essentially unordered. Did I understand that correctly?
So in XV6, the ready queue is essentially unordered. We'll get to that. Okay. Other questions? OK, so as I said, XV6 doesn't represent these queues explicitly. It just scans the process list for things that are in the runnable state for the ready queue. For those various queues for things waiting for I/O, it just scans for things that are in the sleeping state with a particular CHAN setting to indicate what they're waiting for. So we're going to talk a bunch about this problem called scheduling. And we're going to look at CPU scheduling. I'd just like to mention briefly, there are other types of scheduling out there. So for example, we're going to talk about like scheduling a CPU that I'm using interactively. We could schedule things for like a supercomputer where the things are going to run for days. That's a very different scheduling problem. It's still a scheduling problem. We can talk about I/O scheduling. So like deciding when do I let programs write things to the network if I have multiple things that want to use the network at once. That's another scheduling problem. Not what we're going to talk about. Though, many of the things we will talk about have many similarities as far as what solutions you use to these other types of scheduling problems. And in particular, we're going to be focused on scheduling CPUs where programs do a lot of I/O, where other programs, you know, can use the CPU while they're doing that I/O, and where there's only a single core. And I promise the ideas point to more complicated scheduling problems, but you'll observe that maybe this doesn't even apply to your laptop, right? You have multiple cores. So there's a bunch of other things that are going to make it more complicated. We're doing with this very simple and historical version of it. And we're going to primarily try to focus on the scheduling policy, which is what do we remove from the queue? What do we run when first, when we have a chance? So to talk about this, it would be nice to know sort of the mechanics of how the scheduler works, which we're going to have to talk about. And also in the process, we're going to try to look at what is the scheduling policy that XV6 chooses. Because if you look at XV6's code, it doesn't look like they've chosen anything, but they've kind of accidentally chosen a scheduling policy. So let's talk about how XV6 does scheduling. And we mentioned earlier that we have a context switch in XV6. We go from application A to B, and I told you that, oh, we know application A has some sort of exception, and it calls the switch function that switches to application B, which then returns from an exception into a different program. And this is not actually quite what happens. So in reality, there's this other thread that's internal to XV6 with its own stack called the scheduler thread. And the way XV6 is chosen to organize things is that application A switches to this scheduler function, which is a separate thread, which then switches to application B. And the reason they did this is just so they can easily keep the local variables of the scheduler function on a separate stack for programming convenience. On many real OSs, they won't go through this level of indirection, but this is what XV6 does. So XV6, when we decide that we don't want to run application anymore, we switch to the scheduler function. The scheduler function, all it does is figure out what to switch to next. And then in this case, it chose application B. So questions on this sort of high level idea? Yes?
Is this diagram on the slide somewhere?
It will be when I upload an updated version. So let's talk about our scheduler function. So this is the scheduler function that is the separate thread we switch to. And it runs this infinite loop And in that loop, it goes through the table, the array of processes, finds the runnable ones, and then switches to them. So it switches to one, it will switch back to it, and then it will go to the next process until it runs out, in which case it will go back to the beginning. So this is what it does. It just scans through the list of processes, switches to each one it can run. That process switches back to it. It goes through, finds the next one. When it runs out, it goes back to the beginning. Yes?
So the switch back, so originally you switch to a process that is runnable.
Yes.
And you switch back to this once that runnable process is in.
So the question is, when I run a process, I switch back to it? Yes. So that process, when it decides it no longer wants to run anymore, is going to switch back here with its own call to switch that's not on the slide. Does that answer your question? Yes? Can I explain the need for the acquire and release? We want to make sure that no one else is manipulating the process table while we're checking if things are runnable. The main issue is, what if someone is going changing the runnable flag, like to sleeping, while we're checking it? That would be very confusing. So we're going to avoid that. Yes?
Since you only have one CPU, why would anything else change anything?
Question, why would anything else change anything since we only have one CPU? Remember, exceptions can happen. So even with one CPU, we do need that. We need to worry about that. So for example, if some exception happens that causes us to make a process go from sleeping to runnable, we need to make sure we have a consistent view of when it was runnable or not. Or if an exception happens which makes us kill a process, we want to make sure that we don't get confused about whether it's runnable or not. Yes? Do I need a thread for an exception as well? No. So we run exceptions in XV6 in whatever is currently running. So they take over the currently running thread. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So when you switch to the other program, and then who can supposed to switch back?
The question, when we switch to the other program, who can supposed to switch back? The kernel code that's running in the context of the other program. So the question is, the other program has control? Yes, but remember that we're handling exceptions while running that other program in our kernel code, so we can ensure that it switches back at an appropriate time. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Also, because we have a log over here, if you have two ports, and then basically scheduler can only be run.
So the question is, if we have multiple cores, how does this work? So XV6 does support multiple cores, which is probably the primary reason for this lock. And in that case, we'll see that this lock is going to be released when we're running the other program. So we can only have one core iterating through the process list at a time. But as long as something else other than the scheduler iterating through the process list is running, we can still use multiple cores usefully.
So basically the program itself, they can release the lock.
Program itself can release the lock, and in fact will, which we will see. Yes? Question, if we have multiple cores, do we have one table for? XV6's choice is that there's one table for the entire system. So we're not going to talk much about how do you do multi-core scheduling, but you won't be surprised to learn that maybe you want something more sophisticated than that. That would be sort of a topic for a more advanced OS course, how you do that. Yes? Can I explain the program threads thing? So what do you mean, like this? This?
Yeah.
So we talked about when we're running a program, something like a timer interrupt happens, and we want to switch to another program. The way that works in XV6 is we don't switch directly to the other program. Instead, we switch to the scheduler function, which decides what to switch to. Yes?
How can we guarantee that the scheduler function will switch to process B?
How do we guarantee that the scheduler function will switch to process B? We don't. I'm just saying this is apparently what happened in this example, but the scheduler function makes that decision. And we saw that the code for doing it in XV6 is that it's iterating through the list until it finds something to run. Yes?
So why did you say earlier that the scheduling policy was removed from the queue, and in reality we're just trying to choose
So question is, why do they say the scheduling policy is different from the queue if we're just trying to do the same thing? So XP6 has chosen a scheduling policy, but kind of by accident. But it has a scheduling policy. And we could use the same queue. In fact, your assignment will have us use the same queue to do a different scheduling policy. Does that answer your question? So a question, XP6 policy is removing things from you? XP6's policy is to go through in order until it finds something, and it's something we're going to call a round-robin policy, roughly. Okay, so we have our scheduler function. Mentioned we have these locks. We iterate through the process table to find things to run until we find things, and then we switch to them. There's a little extra work around that switch. Some bookkeeping. We have to remember, what's the current process running? So this is to make the myproc function work. So remember, we used myproc in like our system call stuff. This is to make that work. We have to store what we switch to. We have to set up the address space. And we mark it as running. So in the case where XV6 is supporting multiple cores, especially, we don't get confused and try to run this on another core at the same time. Then we switch to it. And when we switch back, we reset the address space and make sure myproc and reset myproc. So when if an exception happens, we know nothing's running right now. Okay, questions? Switch UVM changes the address space. So this changes that mapping from user addresses to real addresses. Okay, so that's our actual switch. So let's look at some other things in this diagram. So here I've shown this sched function. So when you're looking at the XV6 code, you might be looking for, there's a switch to the scheduler thread. Where is that? That's in the sched function. So sched is just a function which calls switch. That's all it does. Just call switch to the scheduler code. So let's talk about sort of a classic example of actually switching to it. So let's look at the example of yield. So when we talked about timer interrupts, we briefly showed, we call this yield function to run another program. So let's look at how that function works. So here's that function. So this is the function which takes us from the running state to the ready state, and also back later on. So what we do is we acquire the process table lock. So we say, no one else manipulate the running processes right now. I'm changing things. Then we mark the current process as runnable instead of running. So we're doing this transition from running to ready. And then we switch to the scheduler, and we go back to that loop. And sometime later, the scheduler will come back to us and say, time to run this program. And it will switch back. It's going to switch back holding that process table lock. So we're going to end up releasing it and going back, and just before it switched back, it set us as running, so that's all set up. So questions about this yield function? Yes?
Did this say scheduler was a function?
The scheduler function? Sched is a function that switches to the scheduler thread. Yes?
Why do you release the lock after?
Why do I release the lock? Because I know the scheduler thread had the lock. So our convention is always going to be that we acquire the lock, we mark ourselves as not running, we switch to the scheduler thread switches back, and then we release the lock. So this ensures that that lock is held while we're doing scheduling stuff and not after. Yes?
Are you releasing the lock only for the current process?
Am I releasing the lock only for the current process? The lock is global. So I'm releasing, the lock is released after I release it for everyone.
But how does it work?
There's one lock for the entire system.
But then if you fork, don't you have two variables?
So when I fork, don't I have two variables? So remember, this is kernel. The kernel state memory is shared between all the processes. Do you remember, like, when you made your write count system call, you had a global variable? That was global for everything. That was super global. Not global like a global variable in a normal program. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Is this yield like a wrapper function to wrap around the actual program I'm about to run?
Or? Question, is this yield a wrapper function? So this yield is a function that is used by the timer interrupt handler, most notably. Does that answer your question?
So it's specific for timer interrupt.
Yes, so it might also be used in some other places, but the timer interrupt is the most notable place that calls it. Yes?
I guess I'm just really confused because we have programs, like say other like external programs, one-on-one, and then basically we have the operating system. But like I guess external program doesn't care about like any of those like log and delete, right? So we have to have the wrapper function around the when does that happen?
So question, we have to have some function run an external program. What do you mean by external?
Like, for example, if I just download like a game to play, that game is like an external program. It's not like built inside the OS operating system.
Yeah, so you're saying, how do we get back to the thing? So this was something, we covered context switches. We recovered like that we like go back to the trap function and then return from an exception. That's how we're going to go back to the normal program. Does that answer your question? So that's okay. Okay, so yield function, this shows sort of the simplest way we invoke the scheduler. So we just switch to that thread, switch back. There's also some special cases. So I mentioned about what about when we have a new process starting, an XV6 that starts with the fork ret function. And this came up when we talked about creating a new thread. We said we set up this stack that was in the middle of a call to something. So it's in the middle called a fork ret, and you can see fork ret when a process starts. So when a process was just created and became ready, when it becomes runnable, the scheduler switches to it, marking it as running, and it just releases the process table lock and returns to the new program to run. So this is how XV6 handles starting a new program with a scheduler. So I've talked about going from new to ready to running, and going from running to ready to running. And we have one more case, which is this waiting state. So how does that work? So we have this sleep function, which confusingly is wait for something. It's not like wait a certain amount of time. And the way it works is it marks we acquire the process table lock, so no one else is manipulating it. Then we mark the process as waiting for a thing identified by this chan variable, for channel, I think. And then we call the scheduler. So we marked ourselves as sleeping, so the scheduler won't switch back to us until something else marks us as runnable. You might say, where does that happen? Well, eventually it will happen when we'll switch back, and there's this function, wakeup1, which given a chan value, which might like represent like keyboard input, scans for programs that are sleeping for that reason and marks them as runnable. So questions? That. Yes?
If the program acquires a lock, how would the scheduler have a lock?
If the program acquires a lock,
how would you acquire another lock in the scheduler?
How would you acquire another lock in the scheduler? So when we talk about locking, we will learn that the types of locks we're using in the kernel, we cannot hold while we're running another program. We'll need some other solution for that. But that's going to be a topic for several weeks later. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we're showing you the XV6 scheduler, how it works. So we have this separate scheduler thread. So we have this loop that's running that we switch to, and it switches back to another program. We always scan the process list to find things that are sleeping or waiting to run. Rather than having separate lists, this seems inefficient. It's a bad data structure, but at least it's simple. That's why XV6 did it. There's no dynamic memory allocation. And our sort of scheduling policy is really tightly coupled to how we happen to arrange the programs. The order we run things in is just the order they're stored on that array. So just kind of by accident, we choose what to run based on how they're arranged in that array rather than some deliberate choice. So let's think about, now that I know what the scheduler does, what would be a better policy? What should we be considering rather than going to the next runnable program? Is there something better we can do? Or what's the best answer? So that's going to be our next big topic, is what's the best answer? So XP6 just goes to the next runnable thing. But what's the best choice? And we're going to talk about this from the perspectives of when XP6's design is based on. We're going to think, just to keep things simple for now, of having one program per user, and presumably multiple users, one thread per program, and independent programs, so I don't need to worry about what if one program is writing output to another. This is to keep things simple. We can remove all these assumptions, and it's just going to make our problem more complicated. But the things we'll learn from looking at this simple case will help us. And I'm going to have a very particular model for what programs do. I'm going to say that programs do some computation and do I/O. And we'll call the computation a CPU burst and the I/O some I/O burst. And the programs do this alternating. They do some this burst of CPU of some amount of time, then some I/O, then a burst of CPU of some amount of time. This is my model of program behavior. Is this entirely accurate? No, but it's a reasonable way of thinking about things. And our goal for our scheduler is to schedule these CPU bursts, that when a program wants to do this little bit of CPU, or maybe a big bit of CPU, we want to run those bits of CPU that need to be done as efficiently as possible, or maybe as some other metric as possible. We'll figure out what things we want to optimize, but we want to run it the best way. And we can kind of measure what things look like if we think of programs this way. So if we think of programs as having these CPU bursts, these bunches of CPU that need to be done between waiting for input of some sort, input from the network, input from a keyboard, we can measure how long those waits are. So here is some measurements from 1966 of how long the waits were for between when we typed a command and when we got the next command prompt. So this is a measure of those CPU bursts. And a property we see here is that most of them are super short. So this is in ticks, which are 15 milliseconds. So most of these in 1966 were less than 30 milliseconds or so. And we have this sort of, you know, drop off. And you might say, well, that's 1966. Surely things are different now. Maybe not really, though this is from 1990, maybe not far enough ahead. It's hard to find real recent data on this. But here we have the length of CPU burst, and you can see the typical type is like 2 to 4 milliseconds of CPU between waiting for input. With this sort of, this is a log scale note, so that's almost everything is sort of in this milliseconds range. And then we have some things which take longer. So for the most part, we're scheduling these little several milliseconds bits of work. We want to run them as best as possible. So we have these short CPU bursts followed by I/O bursts of varying lengths. And most of the CPU bursts are on the order of milliseconds. And that's what we're trying to set up run on the CPU, are these milliseconds of each program needing to run after it gets some input. So our view is going to be that we have a list on our ready queue of the CPU bursts that are ready to run, and we want to choose the best one. Okay. Questions? Yes. Okay. So we're going to have to look at, well, what does best mean? And next time we're going to talk about several different ways we could define best. So best could mean, how fast do we run things from my perspective of when do I like get my program's results? Best could mean, how efficiently am I running everything? How much time am I wasting like figuring out what to run, switching between things? Or it could mean fairness. How well am I treating all my users so they all get equal use, or at least the use they're supposed to get, you know, some are more important than others, of the machine. So we'll look at those in terms of this CPU burst model next time.